the year.
Recreating notable events of passing time. Reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world. ...1924, that was the year.
I don't think the leases will be cancelled. They're perfectly legitimate. I have no money invested in the Teapot Dome... ...and I have nothing in common with Mr. Sinclair. We are just friendly business rivals, that's all.
This was the statement of oil magnate Edward L. Doheny... ...on his way to appear before the committee of the U.S. Senate... ...investigating his loan of $100,000 to Albert B. Fall... ...former Secretary of the Interior in the administration of President Harding. The next day in Washington, D.C., under the heavy questioning of Senator Thomas J. Walsh, said Doheny...
Mr. Fall has been keeping my name out of the discussion for the reason that a full statement might be misunderstood. I wish to inform the committee that on the 30th of November, 1921, I loaned to Albert B. Fall $100,000 upon his promissory note to enable him to purchase a ranch in New Mexico. This sum was loaned to Mr. Fall by me personally.
June 5.
Albert B. Fall, Harry F. Sinclair, Edward L. Doheny Sr., and his son Edward L. Doheny Jr. are indicted in the District of Columbia Supreme Court. Fall, Sinclair, and Doheny Sr. charged with conspiracy. Fall and the two Doheny's charged with bribery.
April 3, 1925. These indictments are dismissed on a technicality. But on May 27 of the same year...
New indictments are returned. Resulting in dismissal or acquittal for all save the former cabinet member. On October 25, 1929, Albert B. Fall was found guilty of having accepted a bribe, sentenced to a year in jail, and fined $100,000. After delays, Fall went to jail in 1931, to be released for good behavior in May 1932, a broken, dispirited old man.
February 18, 1924.
Under fire of the Teapot Dome government leases inquiry, Secretary of the Navy Edwin L. Denby resigned, saying to President Calvin Coolidge in his letter...
I fear my continuance in office would increase your embarrassment.
Another national scandal in 1924.
As a result of financial wizardry surrounding the American Metal Company, a New York grand jury returned an indictment against Harry M. Doherty, charging that he had conspired...
to defraud the United States of its governmental functions and rights, and of his honest, impartial, and unprejudiced services and judgment... as Attorney General.
March 28, 1924.
My dear Mr. President, I hereby acknowledge receipt of your letter of March 27th by the hand of your secretary requesting my resignation as Attorney General of the United States. Solely out of deference to your request and in compliance therewith, I hereby tender my resignation. I most respectfully request that it become effective herewith. Signed, H.M. Doherty, Attorney General.
At Atlantic City, New Jersey, the same day... said Doherty to reporters.
I'm carefree and happy. Right at this minute, I should rather be in Atlantic City than in office. I haven't any plans for the immediate future. I don't need any. Harry M. Doherty is a man who can form his plans rapidly as the occasion arises.
Here's some more telegrams, Mr. Doherty.
Oh, thank you, Len. Oh, now let me see you. I don't think I've got any change for a tip.
Here, Mr. Doherty, let me...
No, thank you. I prefer to keep the loans in the family. I'll borrow a quarter from my son-in-law.
Brought to trial, Harry M. Doherty was freed after the jury had deliberated 66 hours and disagreed.
1924, that was the year.
Sunday, February 3, Washington, D.C. Before a modest house on S Street is huddled a group of 200 men, women, and children, peering in anxious silence at the front door. At about 11:20 a.m., the door opens slowly, quietly. A gaunt, haggard man appears, stands with bended head.
Say, that's Dr. Grayson, Mr. Wilson's physician.
I must tell you that Woodrow Wilson is gone.
Oh.
He passed away in his sleep just a few moments ago. The end came peacefully. A bulletin will be issued shortly.
A few days later, the wartime president of the U.S., Woodrow Wilson, was buried in the great Episcopal Cathedral in the nation's capital.
1924, that was the year...
that the $2 billion soldiers' bonus bill was passed by both houses of the U.S. Congress over President Coolidge's veto.
That was the year...
that an uprising in the small town of Lily, Pennsylvania, gave vent to a battle between residents and a mob of 500 from a neighboring town, wearing the full ceremonial robes of the Ku Klux Klan.
That was the year...
that the Prince of Wales, later King Edward VIII, later the Duke of Windsor, thrilled young American feminine hearts by his visit to the U.S.
That was the year...
that 19 nations competed in the 8th Olympic Games, held near Paris, France. The final point scores...
First, the United States, 94.
Second, France, 64. Third, Sweden, 44 and one-half.
Fourth, Great Britain, 41 and one-half. Fifth, Finland, 34.
Greatest heroes of the 1924 Olympic Games were the trio from Finland, Nurmi, Ritola, and Stenroos, who between them won every long-distance race, including the marathon.
That was the year.
February 12. In the Valley of the Kings near Luxor, Egypt, about 20 men, begrimed by desert dust and the sweat of toil, stand deep in a two-year-old excavation. The heavy lid of an oblong box is being raised. Slowly, cautiously, tediously. The man directing operations is noted Egyptologist Howard Carter. At last, he removes his cork helmet and speaks.
There. That's quite high enough. Well, all I see here is a charred piece of cloth. Do I have your permission, sir, to remove this?
As Secretary of State of Egypt, I grant you permission, Mr. Carter.
Thank you. Oh, gentlemen, our search is ended. Oh, how I wish Lord Carnarvon were here. To his memory really belongs the credit. Gentlemen, for 3,300 years, within this stone sarcophagus has rested the body of Egypt's boy pharaoh, Tutankhamun.
And we may wonder whether or not the smile upon the golden countenance of Egypt's young king was in warm appreciation for the familiarity with which English-speaking peoples welcomed him home. Whether or not he would have replied had we called him by his Tin Pan Alley nickname, King Tut.
1924, that was the year.
That two figures in the world of writing, two figures in the world of sports, two figures in the show world, and one figure in the world of labor died.
In the world of letters,
Francis Hogden Burnett, author of Little Lord Fauntleroy, and Laura Jean Libbey, writer, among others, of Miss Middleton's Lover, or Pothead on their bridal tour.
In the world of sports,
famous Harvard football coach, Percy D. Houghton, and the grand old man of the turf, Pop Gears.
In the show world,
American dean of minstrelsy, Lou Dockstader, and prolific composer of light operatic literature, Victor Herbert.
And in the world of labor,
president of the American Federation of Labor, Samuel Gompers.
1924, that was the year
that two American multimillionaires announced on the same day huge donations in the interest of higher education.
Charlottesville, North Carolina.
James B. Duke, tobacco king and developer of water power systems in the Carolinas, created a trust fund to eventually amount to $40 million for charitable, religious, and educational purposes. Thereupon, Trinity College in Durham, North Carolina, became Duke University, received $16 million.
Rochester, New York.
George Eastman, camera king, announced the donation of $15 million to educational institutions and said,
I am upwards of 70 years old and feel that I would like to see results from this money within the natural term of my remaining years. One of the reasons why I welcome this disposition of my Kodak stock is that it separates me from money-making for myself and will give me the benefit of a somewhat more detached position in respect to human affairs.
The four institutions of higher learning benefiting through Eastman's donation were the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the University of Rochester, Hampton Institute, and Tuskegee College.
That was the year.
You were reading Michael Arlen's sensational The Green Hat, The Green Bay Tree by Louis Bromfield, and Edna Ferber's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, So Big.
1924, that was the year.
That stage successes included Outward Bound with Alfred Lunt and Leslie Howard, The Beggar on Horseback, What Price Glory, George Kelly's The Show-Off, and George Arliss in Old English.
That was the year.
That box office successes of the screen were The Thief of Baghdad, The Ten Commandments, The Seahawk, and Monsieur Bocquet.
And that was the year.
That music counters everywhere sold thousands of copies of one of your perennial favorites.
Since you've gone away, one thing is clear to me. You were dearer than dear to me.